Hi, and welcome to Intern Ready OBGYN, a podcast aimed at helping you excel during your intern year in OBGYN. My name is Dr. Lucy Brown. I'm a resident at Johns Hopkins and your host for Intern Ready OBGYN.
Hello, and welcome back to Intern Ready. I'm Dr. Lucy Brown, and today I'm lucky to be joined by Dr. Michelle Cush. She's an assistant professor in the Department of OBGYN at Johns Hopkins, and she's an expert in the Center of Fetal Therapy. All right. And so to start, what is fetal therapy? How do we define it?
Yes. So fetal therapy is a subspecialty of maternal fetal medicine. We are the F in MFM, and we're focused on treating fetal disease before birth. We look for diseases where we can potentially offer a cure, such as anemia or twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, where we can improve outcomes, such as fetal spina bifidas and prenatal closures, or congenital diaphragmatic hernias with our feto balloons. Or we're trying to optimize the condition at birth with our transplacental therapies for fetal arrhythmias or fetal tumors, or even perhaps cystic fibrosis.
All right. That was a great overview. So let's talk specific fetal therapy conditions and how you may be involved.
Yes. So there are several of our procedures which we perform on labor and delivery. And today I just wanted to highlight the most common ones.
Nice.
So we're going to start with fetal anemia and our fetal transfusion. So we really are the busiest fetal transfusion center in the Mid-Atlantic, if not the Eastern Seaboard. We have done about 600 transfusions since the opening of the center, and we're on target to do about 100 this year.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the most common reasons to do a fetal transfusion would be for alloimmunization, which is where mom has antibodies against a fetal red cell antigen, which causes destruction of those red blood cells, as well as infectious such as parvo or high drops with a genetic reason for a fetal anemia.
So sometimes we have these patients on our labor and delivery service. Why do these procedures need to be performed on L&D?
Oh, yes. Once we reach viability, there is the potential of a non-reassuring status or them not tolerating the transfusion, and they might need an emergent delivery. That happens in a less than 1% of our cases, but it's not zero. So that's why we're on labor and delivery.
Makes sense.
Right. And we do them on labor and delivery after a betamethasone course has been completed. Sometimes they need tocolysis, such as magnesium or terbutaline. And they do need monitoring of the fetus and uterine activity pre and post procedure.
Right.
And so the risks of doing a fetal blood sampling or a fetal transfusion, I touched on one, an emergent delivery,
right,
but also preterm contractions or preterm labor, rupture of membranes, a non-reassuring fetal heart rate tracing. And we have to remember that we paralyze our fetuses to do these procedures. So when we're monitoring them afterwards, if there is a deceleration, we need to move mom because the baby can't move off of their own cord.
Okay. I didn't know that actually. And so when they, I know at Hopkins, oftentimes they're sent from clinic or they already have this planned admission. So what do we do when they get to L&D?
Yes. So our general care path is they come early in the morning downstairs to the center for an ultrasound. So we know the fetal weight, which is what we base our medications and our transfusions on. They come upstairs, their NPO, and we've already done their consents in the center. So no consents should need to be obtained unless we do ask you if there's a pressing issue.
Sure.
They'll meet with the OB anesthesiologist. They will have an IV placed. They'll be placed on continuous monitoring. And then we generally perform these in a triage room. If it does need to be performed in an operating room, we will communicate that with you. And then the neonatologists are alerted. So they're on standby. So they also are aware that if they receive this baby in an emergent situation, they are paralyzed.
Right.
And then we perform the transfusion. Transfusions generally take around 20 minutes or so. So they're not long procedures. And then afterwards, you know, the fetus is paralyzed. So we monitor. Generally, we're looking for the fetal heart rate pattern, which will not have as much variability at first, and we're looking for uterine activity. After about 1 hour, if they're not contracting in a pattern that's concerning for preterm labor and the heart rate is overall reassuring, they can start a clear liquid diet. And then after 2 hours, again, no preterm labor, reactive category one tracing, they can eat. And as long as they're feeling the baby move, that's when they can be discharged home.
That's helpful for you know, all of us are taking care of these patients, and they have kind of unique plans compared to other of our like antepartum patients. So it's very helpful to know the strategy. So let's start by going through some of the most common syndromes and conditions that you see.
Oh, sure. So one of the most common surgical procedures of ours that you will encounter is a fetoscopic laser ablation for twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. And in essence, twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome happens in monochorionic pregnancy. So they share a placenta. And on this placenta, there are vascular anastomoses between the two fetuses. And these are there. Most often, everything that goes across comes back in a different pathway and it's balanced. Mm-hmm. However, in a small subset, around 15% of monochorionic twins, they develop an imbalance of volume. So someone's giving away more volume than they are receiving. So you have a donor mm-hmm. and a recipient of volume. And this can lead to fetal heart failure. It can lead to demise of one of the fetuses if it continues to progress and is unchecked. So in those circumstances, we offer a laser ablation where we use laser energy to close those vascular anastomoses in an effort to treat twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, or TTTS.
Nice. Is it usually the recipient that tends to be sicker and get heart failure?
They are. It has different impacts on each fetus. So mm-hmm. the donor is giving away the volume. Mm-hmm. And to compensate for that, they try at first to make a little bit more urine, but they're not mm-hmm. very successful because they're drinking up more than they're giving away. So the fluid around them goes down. They redistribute blood flow because you don't need your kidneys as a fetus.
Right.
So eventually you're really not producing urine. So that's why we see empty bladders on these fetuses. And so that's why a donor, their fluid goes down. Now the recipient has different impacts because mm-hmm. they're volume overloaded.
Right.
And that's reflected in the extra fluid around them. Right? They have huge amounts of amniotic fluid. Their bladders are really full. You can see even some dilation in the renal pelvis from that extra volume. And their heart is very mm-hmm. full. And if your heart is very full, one, it has to work harder, but it also impacts the vascular flow. So they are at higher risk of cardiac impacts from being a recipient.
It makes sense. What are some risks of the laser ablation?
Yes. So some of the risks are secondary to what we do during the procedure. So we have to place an instrument into the pregnant uterus that's overly distended. So that, you know, makes sense. We're at risk of contractions of preterm labor. We're also at risk of rupture of membranes, as well as shearing the membranes off of the uterine wall. And that's called membrane separation. That in of itself increases the risk of early labor, mm-hmm. early contractions, or rupture of membranes. We're also at risk of bleeding. The transfusion rate of our patients undergoing a fetoscopic laser is under 2%, but it's not zero. It's more often when the placenta is anterior and we have to enter the uterus on the lateral aspect where the large maternal vessels are. So that's something always to keep in mind, and we will communicate that with you. So those are the big immediate risk factors from a laser.
Okay. It's helpful. So in terms of the resident perspective, what is our role in caring for this patient?
Oh, yes. Preoperatively, these patients often will receive a dose of indomethacin. Mm-hmm. We will communicate that to you. They receive a Foley prior to going back into the operating room. When they come out of the operating room, typically they are on magnesium sulfate, and we'll communicate that with you. We continue that for about 12 to 24 hours mm-hmm. post-procedure, and we titrate that magnesium up or down by 0.5 grams per hour, and that's based on the uterine activity. Our goal is 6 contractions or less an hour, and you know, we move up and down with the magnesium and generally try to leave them at 2 grams an hour if possible. The Foley stays in overnight. If they're nice and stable, not having a lot of uterine activity, they can have clears, but otherwise we advance them to a regular diet in the morning. On post-op day one, the magnesium and Foley typically come out around 6 in the morning, and they can have breakfast. and we check a morning CBC, and then we'll do an ultrasound either upstairs or down in the center to look to see if the fetus has survived the surgery, to look at their cervical length and to determine when they should come back and if they can go home.
Gotcha.
All right. So what other procedures do you guys do?
Okay. Our biggest surgery that we perform are the prenatal fetal spina bifida closures or MMC repairs or closures. They're typically performed around 24 to 26 weeks of gestation, and it's in the setting of an isolated anomaly with normal genetics. These patients travel from all over for this procedure, and it's based on the MOMS trial. We offer both open and fetoscopic closures here at Hopkins. These patients are admitted the night before the case. There's a nursing checklist as well as a care path that are available to you to guide you for our plans. And I typically sit down with the team the week before and the day before going over sort of what our anticipated care path will be. But they're admitted the night before. We place an IV. They can drink clears until about 4 a.m. There is an MMC order set that we can go through together. And it just lists all the preoperative things, the preoperative antibiotics, the SCDs, the Foley, the use of heparin. The morning of, our patients receive an A-line and they'll receive a dose of indomethacin. We do start magnesium before the case, which is different than our twin-to-twins. Immediately post-operatively, this is the biggest risk time for them. And the biggest maternal risk is pulmonary edema. And so it's very important to have strict I's and O's, understand what their respiratory status is with frequent checks, as well as IS use, the inspiratory spirometer. It really makes a huge difference. Like, we really harp on that. We titrate the magnesium and continue the indomethacin. And they will have continuous fetal monitoring after this procedure because, again, these fetuses will be paralyzed. Yeah. So we need to know if they're having decelerations and uterine activity. Preterm labor is second in line as the highest risk factor for these procedures. So we're making an incision either very small for the fetoscopic ports or larger for an open MMC, but uterine activity. So contractions, rupture of membranes. The bleeding risk is very small, but not absent. And then pulmonary edema is really what we're thinking on post-op day zero.
Got it. And then what are you actually doing with the MMC closure?
Yes. So either open or fetoscopic. This could be a whole
episode.
Oh, yes, for sure. So, but what we're doing is we are gaining access to the intrauterine cavity for the pediatric neurosurgeons to perform a closure. And their goal is to perform a watertight closure of the fetal MMC. And the role of that is to, one, ideally reverse the Chiari2 malformation, to stabilize the ventriculomegaly. The ventriculomegaly won't go away, and it may actually slightly increase for physiologic reasons. But the goal is to reverse that Chiari2 to reduce the potential of the brainstem syndrome or the brainstem impacts, as well as reduce the need for a shunt. We know in the MOMS trial that they did have delayed or decreased needs for the VP shunt placement, which is really important because those have complications too. And they had improved ambulation at about 30 months of age. That's not guaranteed, but the idea is that the neural placode and those nerve endings are now protected from the amniotic fluid, which is felt to be caustic to them with that exposure.
And I can link, we'll link the MOMS trial to the bottom of this episode if you're curious and would like to read more.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah. All right. What other common procedures are you guys doing regularly?
Yes. I mean, we've spoken about our most common ones that occur on labor and delivery, but we do many other procedures. This is definitely not all-encompassing of what fetal therapy is. So we often have shunt placements, either into a chest for a fetal pleural effusion or into a bladder for a lower urinary tract outlet obstruction that's called LUTO. So there are shunt placements. We also are part of the RAFT trial, which is now closed, but we have a RAFT registry, which is the renal anhydramnios fetal fluid replacement therapy or serial amnioinfusions, where we are placing fluid back into the uterus mm-hmm. in an effort to salvage pulmonary function in fetuses who have renal failure. So that's something that we typically do in our center, but occasionally they do need to be performed upstairs if they're having a lot of uterine activity.
Mm-hmm. Upstairs and as oh, in our late delivery.
No, it's okay. Yes. And so, you know, those are our other procedures that we didn't necessarily talk about mm-hmm. today, and there are many others. But the next thing is we have many fetuses who require transplacental therapy. And that's, you know, giving mom a medication to cross the placenta to impact the fetus. And the most common one that we do is for fetal arrhythmias or SVT. And those patients do actually stay on labor and delivery because we need baseline labs on mom, which include a complete metabolic panel and an ionized calcium. We need a baseline EKG so we know what her cardiac indices are, and we need continuous monitoring while we're loading her on these medications that she herself actually doesn't need. So it's important to monitor her cardiac status. For SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, which is in a fetus, tachycardia greater than 180 beats per minute, greater than 10% of the time, and not all of those need to be treated, so we might need to monitor them on labor and delivery with continuous fetal monitoring to understand how much time they're spending in this arrhythmia.
Mm-hmm.
And we would treat generally if it's more than 50% of the time, or if we're seeing high drops, which is fetal heart failure,
mm-hmm.
or if it's an even higher rate, greater than 280 beats per minute. And how we do this is we give mom a medication, most commonly flecainide, but there are other medications that we may use, such as digoxin mm-hmm. or amiodarone. We load those medications and we look for a fetal response, which generally is not immediate. It takes, you know, 48 to 72 hours. Sometimes that response happens in a week. They don't necessarily need to stay in the hospital that long, but during the acute loading phase that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so once those patients are discharged, we follow them weekly in the center with weekly maternal EKGs and ultrasounds assessing the fetal status and rhythm.
Right. That was excellent summary of the most common like fetal therapy procedures. Any last minute advice that you would want to give our incoming interns or just residents in general that are caring for these patients?
Oh, yes. You guys are a very valuable part of our team. Fetal therapy is not scary. It's really fun. And it's never the same twice, but you are our eyes and our ears, and we really rely on you as a part of our team looking after our patients. And I just want to stress that if you have concerns, call us. You can always reach us on the fetal therapy phone. We pass it back and forth, but it's always on 24/7, and that phone number is 844-543-3825. I want to sort of guide you away from maybe sending an Epic chat if you're concerned about a patient, because those aren't always immediately seen, and you can always reach us by phone. And if you have a concern, lay eyes on the patient,
mm-hmm.
lay hands on the patient, and that'll give you so much more information when you reach out to us.
Absolutely. Great. Well, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Intern Ready OBGYN. We hope you found today's podcast helpful. Don't forget to subscribe below, rate the podcast, leave a review, or suggest a new episode.